From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to this Friday edition of Washington Watch. I am your host today, Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins. We have a sobering edition of Washington Watch to bring you today with some very compelling stories that are going to make you want to do something. So listen well. A South Korean national, along with 337 child pornographers in 23 states and 11 countries, have been arrested and charged in the takedown of the largest darknet child pornography website in the world. Plus, dozens of minor victims who were being actively abused by the users of the site were rescued. In just a minute, I'll talk with Jesse Liu, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia. In my second segment, suicide and homicide rates are rising among 10 to 24-year-olds, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Center for Health Statistics. I'll talk with Dr. Steve Gersovich, licensed psychiatrist and founder and president of Key Ministry, about what he believes are some contributing factors and how we can ensure that fewer people are victims. At the bottom of the hour, the D.C. Council considered the absurd idea of legalizing prostitution in our nation's capital yesterday after having rejected a similar bill in 2017. 170 people signed up to testify, the majority of whom were opposed to it. And in fact, the testimony went on for over 12 hours and into midnight today. On one side, rows of people wore orange stickers that read, "Protect survivors, not buyers." On the other side, activists wore white shirts that said, "Sex workers deserve housing, not handcuffs." I'll talk with Katherine Johnson, FRC's research fellow for legal and policy studies. And at 42 past the hour, 1 million Uyghur Muslims are being held in China's gulags, ones that they were finally forced to admit existed. A woman named Seyrigul Sautbay managed to escape, and we'll learn more about her incredible firsthand story of indoctrination, torture, and sexual abuse. I'll talk with Louisa Greve, Director of External Affairs for the Uyghur Human Rights Project. As a reminder, follow the podcast for today's program at tonyperkins.com. Follow Tony on Twitter if you'd like at T Perkins or me at Sarah P. Perry. Well, our first story is a disheartening one, but I am encouraged by its eventual outcome and the heroism of the individual I'm about to talk to. A South Korean national and 337 child pornographers across the world have been arrested and charged in the takedown of the largest darknet child porn site in the world. Plus, dozens of minor victims who were being actively abused are being rescued, and there is a pending lawsuit for recompense, financial remuneration to the victims. Joining me now to discuss this victory for justice is Jesse Liu, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia. Jesse, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So the child porn site was called Welcome to Video. This was run by 23-year-old Jong Woo-sun, 23. That in and of itself, to me, is stunning that he was that young and a South Korean national. But how long had you been tracking their operations?
Well, the website went up in 2015, and we eventually took it down with the assistance of our law enforcement counterparts in South Korea, as well as in the UK and Germany in March of 2018. And since then, we've been continuing to investigate the users of the site. It's really remarkable, I think, just the sheer amount of child pornography that was on this website, more than 250,000 videos, and users downloaded more than 1 million files. Altogether, we seized about 8 terabytes of child pornography on this one website.
Oh, dear Lord. And I did read a statistic that 45% of the content was brand new. In other words, not a piece that had been circulating before, but this was brand new content that were uploaded by these individual users. I find that absolutely stunning because it is such a big operation. The total quantity was massive, and this actually took the assistance of different nations, different divisions within the U.S., and multiple agencies to actually bring down, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Well, we're very, very pleased with the partnership that we had at the Department of Justice with our counterparts at IRS Criminal Investigation, as well as ICE Homeland Security Investigations. And of course, as I said before, we had a fantastic partnership with our law enforcement counterparts in South Korea, the UK, and Germany. As you mentioned, there were hundreds of subjects who were arrested around the world in a number of countries. And so we had fantastic cooperation from law enforcement in those countries as well.
Okay, so my question is, in a project, in a takedown this massive, what is the sort of first inkling that something's going on and that it has to be tracked? What initially tipped you off so that you became aware?
Well, this investigation was begun by IRSCI, Criminal Investigation, and it sounds a little bit surprising because I think when most of us think of IRS Criminal Investigation, we're thinking of tax investigation.
Tax fraud, sure.
Exactly. But it began with a tip, and then law enforcement was very dogged about following it, and we eventually were able to discover that the administrator of this site lived in South Korea, and he was actually running it out of his bedroom in South Korea.
Oh. Wow. And this was a cryptocurrency takedown. In other words, they were using Bitcoin to sort of further shield his identity, right?
Yes. I mean, it's really very interesting because it's one of the first times that we have seen cryptocurrency in the context of commercial child pornography. So the way this site worked was that people could get credits by uploading their own original child pornography. They could use Bitcoin to buy access that would allow them to download certain amounts of child pornography. And so it was really a very heinous use of cryptocurrency. And of course, it also helped maintain anonymity for the users as well as for the administrator of the site.
Now, of these hundreds of individuals who were charged, did you find any similarities, any commonalities in traits, genders, races of any of these offenders that you could identify?
Well, they are mostly male, but other than that, I think they really span the gamut in terms of backgrounds. It's disheartening to us because we found in our work that child exploitation is a problem that just seems extremely widespread, and we continue to fight it as hard as we can, but there seems to be just an endless number of cases, and I think what that tells us is that we have to keep it up. We really can't rest. It's one of the worst forms of evil I think anybody could ever imagine. Yes. It's obviously terrible for the children who go through it. And as government officials and as a society, I think it's something that we simply can't take our eye off of. We really need to keep up the pressure and to send the message to child exploiters and child pornographers that if you are out there doing this, we will find you and we will prosecute you.
I am so glad that your passion is evident to our listeners right now, because for all of us listening, we do understand how hideous it is. In fact, even just to read your testimony that you offered earlier this week, it really did make my stomach turn. I read your remarks with a grimace on my face because I have three children of my own, and the thought of the exploitation and the pain and humiliation and just patent evil that underlies these individual crimes is stomach turning for us. And this individual made no bones about the fact that he was looking for child porn specifically. In fact, the website came with a warning that said, "Do not upload adult porn." I mean, this was an individual who was fully unapologetic about what he was doing on that website.
That's right. We were all stunned when we saw that. And I think it's something that's very hard to get out of your mind, just the fact that this website said expressly, "Do not upload adult porn." Mm-hmm. It was clearly looking for child pornography. And in the 8 terabytes or so of material that we seized, That material depicted prepubescent children, toddlers, and even infants, and it's really just horrifying.
Oh, horrifying is the precise word that I would have used for this. Even as young as infants, you have to wonder what the level of depravity is there. But I am stunned by the fact that this, first of all, was such a successful operation. 337 individuals spanning the globe, truly, with the assistance of all of these agencies and all of these different countries. What was the reaction of some of these users when they were fully arrested? Do you think that these individuals believed that they were entirely shielded, that the dark web and the use of cryptocurrency were going to be enough to keep the shielding eyes of the government away?
I think many people did and do think that, and that's one of the things that we wanted to make clear in this announcement, is that it may be that people who are doing criminal activity on the dark web, whether it be child pornography or selling illegal drugs or anything else, may believe that they are shielded by using the dark web, by using cryptocurrency. That's not the case. The Department of Justice and the U.S. government in general, as well as our international partners, are very focused on identifying people who are engaging in criminal activity on the dark web, who are engaging in criminal activity using cryptocurrency, and that is not going to protect them from the long arm of the law. So that's the message that we really want to get out there, and I'm glad you're helping us do it.
So 23 kids were also rescued from their abusers as a result of this investigation, which is, again, as a mom, so heartening to me to know that there were individuals who were in the process of being abused and exploited, and you were able to rescue them. Can you tell me a story about one of the minors?
Every case is different, but what I will say is that our agents across the world were incredibly diligent in trying to identify who the children are. That's obviously not always easy to do, and they have to do some very creative legwork to be able to figure that out, and very energetic about making sure that they, once they were able to identify an individual child, to get the right law enforcement authorities on board, and sometimes that means local law enforcement where that child lives, and react very, very quickly to actually get the child to a safe place.
Boy, this is quite the reminder to make sure that as parents, we are setting safeguards on computers. We are being diligent in the protection of our own kids. We are blocking inappropriate content, because it just goes to show you how easily something like this happens, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I think you really can't be too careful.
Well, on behalf of the Family Research Council, we have to thank you for your good efforts, the efforts of all of the other related agencies. But specifically as a mom, Jesse, I have to tell you, you are someone I consider to be nothing short of a hero. So thanks for being with us today on Washington Watch.
That's very kind. Thank you very much. It was great talking with you.
Great to talk to you, too. This is Washington Watch. I'm sitting in for Tony Perkins today. What an excellent ending to a terrible story, and an encouragement to be diligent in everything that we do. Coming up next, Dr. Steve Gersovich, licensed psychiatrist and president of Key Ministry, joins me about some new numbers out from the CDC. Next on Washington Watch.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christian's call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org/engage.
News. We can get it from many sources, but what can you trust these days? Where can you get news that doesn't make you as suspicious as you are informed? If you're looking for something better, for honest coverage of the latest news, one trusted news source I look to is the Washington Times. When preparing for the radio program and selecting guests to join me on the show, I will often read the Washington Times and have their reporters join me here on the program because I trust how they cover the news. Join me and more than 7 million readers who turn to the Washington Times every month to get real, trusted news. For a limited time only, listeners of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins will receive a special annual rate of $69.95 for the first year. Subscribe to the Washington Times and get this special offer by using my name and visiting washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins. That's washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday afternoon. Well, more teens and young adults have come to a violent end in recent years, dying either at their own hand or another. New federal data just shows we are now dealing with rising rates of suicide and homicide among 10 to 24-year-olds, according to the new report from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Center on Health Statistics. One of the statisticians, Sally Curtin, who follows these trends closely, says, quote, "Recently in the last few years, they're both trending upward. Suicide began to turn upward earlier in 2007, and now in 2014, homicide turned around as well. Those are the leading causes of death, and they are both increasing." Joining me now with his analysis is Dr. Steve Gersovich, my friend, founder and president of Key Ministry, and a licensed psychiatrist. Dr. Gersovich, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Sarah, nice to talk to you today, but I'd rather not be talking to you about this.
Oh, I agree. So let's see if we can make some meaning out of the madness here. So 10 to 12, and then further up to 24, that age group in its entirety rose 56% between 2000 and 2017. Why is this pace increasing, particularly among these younger kids who may not have any experience with mental illness in their lives?
Well, it's a complex situation, but in my mind, I think that the structures that we have in place to protect emotionally vulnerable kids are eroding. Mm. And when I look at this over the last 10 years, there are three trends that I would identify that I think folks need to look at more closely. The first is smartphones and this propensity that kids have to negatively compare themselves to other people is a lot greater when you have access to Instagram and Snapchat. Mm-hmm. I just got back about midnight last night from American Academy of Child Adolescent Psychiatry research meetings. There was a study that got presented there that kids who spent 3 or more hours on their portable electronic devices were 60% more likely to develop depression than kids who used them for an hour a day or less.
Oh, wow.
So I think the smartphones are one, you know, are one clear precipitant or factor that you look at the expanded use over the last 10 years, it fits very nicely over, you know, some of the data that the CDC reported. The second is the emphasis in our culture on sexual expression.
Mm-hmm.
So that we know that rates of suicidal thinking and behavior increase dramatically when teens start to violate sexual boundaries. When we're looking at data, this is the 2015 National Youth Risk Behavior Survey. Teenagers who'd had sexual contact with a member of the same sex and or the opposite sex were 12 times more likely to require medical attention for a suicide attempt compared to those kids who weren't sexually active.
Oh, wow.
Boys who were sexually active were 7 times more likely to require attention for a suicide attempt if they were sexually active with the opposite sex compared to kids who weren't sexually active. Girls were 3 times more likely to require attention for a suicide attempt, medical attention for a suicide attempt. So that when kids start crossing sexual boundaries, that's oftentimes where we see these large spikes in suicidal behavior. And if you look at the data, with each sexual contact that kids have, the risk for suicide continues to increase. And then finally, the third thing that I would put out there is the diminishing role of religion in the lives of our teens.
Oh, amen.
I don't know if you saw it. Yeah, there was this Pew Foundation study that came out within the last day or two that shows that there are 7 million fewer adult Christians in the United States than there were 10 years ago, mm-hmm. even though there are 25 million more adults in the United States than there were 10 years ago. There's a study last year from Columbia University that noted that rates of suicidal thinking and behavior were lower among teens who had parents for whom their faith was important. And you look at the data from the Pew study, and you know, we know in general that for individuals who, you know, for whom their faith is important, suicide rates are significantly lower than the general population. Mm. The millennials are the first generation of Americans in which Christians are in the minority, and I wouldn't doubt that the situation is even worse for those who are in Generation Z.
I worry the same, considering I have a number of up-and-coming children that are going to be precisely within that age range. That's why it's so important for us to maintain a good example and good religious instruction, because the numbers are dwindling.
Well, absolutely. And so, you know, the question, if a parent asked me, well, what should they do? One of the things that I would look at is that, you know, if my kids were of that age again, they wouldn't be getting smartphones until they're well into high school and only with very close parental supervision. Mm. The second thing that I would look at, there was an interesting study that got presented at this meeting where they showed that kids who pray on a regular basis are significantly less likely to develop depression than kids in the general population. And so that, you know, as a parent, one of the things that I would be trying to do is to cultivate the importance of faith in family life, regularly praying together as a family, studying the Bible mm-hmm. together as a family, serving together. Because interestingly enough, in this same study out of Virginia Tech, they didn't see a relationship between church attendance or youth group participation and a decreased risk for suicide. It was only when the kids had internalized their faith and were practicing it on their own and, you know, truly had like a relationship with God that it seemed to offer protective value.
Oh, wow. You know, it's so interesting to me that there is, in fact, precisely as God promises us, not only an insulating effect of prayer in that he is able to show his love for us, but that if we spend time praying to him, that he gives us precisely what he knows that we need. And in a lot of these cases, and we know this full well from experience, it is God's assistance, even in moments of darkest depression, that is exactly what we need. Dr. Steve Gersovich of Key Ministry, please go to their website, keyministry.org. He runs a wonderful practice with resources for parents dealing with all kinds of disabilities and mental health issues. Well, you won't believe it, but the D.C. City Council is now thinking of legalizing prostitution yet again. So joining me up next is Katherine Johnson, FRC's Research Fellow for Legal and Policy Studies, who will talk to me about the madhouse that was yesterday's D.C. hearing. That's next on Washington Watch.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C. I want to invite you to join Luana and myself, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through June the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the Garden Tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday afternoon. Just as a reminder, go to TonyPerkins.com, which is the website for today's podcast. Follow Tony on Twitter at TPerkins or me at Sarah P. Perry. Well, D.C. is once again considering the legalization of prostitution. And the hearing yesterday on precisely that bill was quite a madhouse. So we're going to talk about some of the specifics with FRC's fellow for research and legal policy studies, Katherine Johnson. She was at the hearing yesterday. She's going to give us some specifics on the bill in addition to some of the madhouse antics. Katherine, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me. Yes, this bill eliminates criminal penalties for buying or selling sex in D.C. In addition, it removes fines or prison terms for operating brothels. So FRC was there yesterday to the D.C. Council to testify against this dangerous and concerning law, especially for women.
Okay, so they've framed this in terms of sex work, right, as opposed to prostitution, because sex work gives it a veneer of sort of legal, sort of protected and benign, legitimate workness, right?
Exactly.
Workness, not a work. Legitimacy. How about that?
Exactly. That's the term they're using, sex work. And they actually have a few reasons that they're advocating for this. One, they say it's just empowering that women can sell their bodies. We know how completely misguided this is based on the dozens of testimonies of survivors who spoke, who said they felt anything but empowered, rather powerless when they were prostitutes. They could also look to over 200 written statements from survivors who notified them that the only people who would be empowered by this bill is actually the pimps themselves and the exploiters. They also try to argue that this bill will actually help women get out of prostitution. They say it'll remove the stigma of it, so women will be able to get out and not have any stigma attached to them. We also know this is completely false. The bill doesn't do a single thing to help women get out of this situation, rehabilitate them, or anything else. So at the end of the day, all it is an attempt to legitimize the buying and selling of humans.
Absolutely. And of course, we naturally think of sexual exploitation and how many children, for example, are sex trafficked. This, to me, seems like it would simply provide an open door for the continuation of these kinds of criminal enterprises. Did we not learn anything from the Jeffrey Epstein case?
Exactly. And there were actually a lot of children lawyers there who testified, and they actually looked at a study that said there would be a 20% increase in demand for sex if this were legalized. 20% of men said they would buy sex if it were legal. And there's simply not enough women to fill that gap. And you know the pimps aren't going to allow this business to go unutilized. So to fill in the gaps, they'll pry on the most vulnerable, who are the children. And Janet Rodriguez, who's actually one of the survivors, said you cannot separate prostitution from sex trafficking.
Right.
And that these go hand in hand. And so really, children will be an additional victim of this bill.
Well, and then, of course, you take our lovely nation's capital and you turn it into America's first official red light district, aside from a few handful of counties out in Las Vegas. But Las Vegas is its own entity. I don't necessarily want D.C. to be known as the nation's first red light district. Do you?
No, I would definitely not. And even if you look at the other countries, New Zealand, where this has been legalized, there hasn't been any decrease in violence against women. And talking about, you know, D.C. being the leader in this, we ask, why do we pass laws? We pass laws to encourage behavior, discourage behavior. And when you have buyers saying that they view women as objects to be disposed of, this law is essentially saying that we want to encourage the notion that women are just products to be bought, and women certainly are not.
Give me a sense of the environment here at this hearing, because there were some very interesting dynamics at play, and this went on quite a long time, didn't it?
It did. There were about 175 witnesses, and really spiritual warfare would be the best way to describe it. You had a pastor come up and speak, and he asked one of the best questions, which is, how did we get here? He talked about slavery and the horrendous stain that is on our country and said, how are we once again discussing and debating whether or not human beings can be sold and used? And when he spoke about the church, the other side would laugh and make fun of him. You'd even have victims share their stories of how they would look, and to their right, one other woman would be shot and killed, and how they would have to get right back to their duties and keep going. And you would just see the other side roll their eyes and say liar and everything else. And just, I had all the more respect and compassion for these women who stood up to help protect other women.
Did they allow any testimony from victims of sex trafficking? Because I think that would be powerful.
They did, and that really was some of the most powerful, powerful stories there were. Women who said that they had been trafficked, and then a few years later, they escaped their pimp, and they still stayed in the industry because they thought that this was all that they knew. And it wasn't until looking back they realized that wasn't a choice. They were still coerced because of everything they had been through. And so even if the council tried to say that this would only allow women who wanted to be in there, they said there's really no way to tell whether women are actually coerced or want to be there. So their stories I really did find the most compelling.
Well, and this is sort of emblematic, isn't it, of the way that there is a progressive march away from immutable truth and into anything goes. And the fact that the ACLU and the National Center for Trans Equality were there indicates to me everything I need to know about whether or not this is a good idea.
Yep, exactly.
So this has been Katherine Johnson, FRC's Research Fellow for Legal and Policy Studies. You are listening to Washington Watch. I am sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday afternoon. Coming up next, a woman named Sehrigul Sautbay managed to escape from a detention center, a concentration camp that China claimed did not exist. I'll talk with Louisa Greve, Director of External Affairs for the Uyghur Human Rights Project, coming up next on Washington Watch.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C. I want to invite you to join Luana and myself, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through June the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the Garden Tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Planned Parenthood is not pro-woman. For decades, the nation's leading abortion supplier has claimed to be the champion of women's rights, but nothing could be farther from the truth. Planned Parenthood has repeatedly violated the law and violated women, from aiding and abetting sex traffickers, covering up child sexual abuse, and selling the remains of aborted baby parts, to ignoring the devastating effects that abortion has on women's physical and mental health. From its racist eugenic roots to the targeting of vulnerable communities, Planned Parenthood is an organization that not only promotes a culture of death, but makes it a reality. In a new brochure from FRC, you will find evidence that will challenge your assumptions about Planned Parenthood and equip you with the information you need to be a true champion for women and the lives of unborn children. To order this brochure and to download your free digital copy, visit frc.org/Planned Parenthood.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christians' call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org/engage.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday edition. Well, there are harrowing stories, and then there are stories that burrow into the marrow of your bones, and this is one of them. Sarah Gul Sotbe is a survivor of China's concentration camps, and she is nothing short of a miracle. The most excruciating forms of torture and abuse are happening behind the barbed wire walls that Beijing has been trying to hide for years. And for the million people trapped inside China's camps, the only hope they have to escape their tormentors is international attention and pressure. And that is part of what we are trying to do here today. So Sarah Gul, a 43-year-old Muslim, managed to escape. She has been granted asylum by Sweden and has told her story recently in the press. But joining me now with her insight into the horror that China does not want you to know about and about the very thinly veiled propaganda effort to show the West that these are nothing more than simply education camps is Louisa Grev, Director of External Affairs for the Uyghur Human Rights Project, and I'm glad to have her. Louisa, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
So before we tell the story of Sarah Gul, help us understand why, in this particular context, do the Chinese communists feel so threatened by the Uyghur Muslims that they would forcibly round them up and put them in these concentration camps?
It's hard to say because, as you pointed out, the public messaging, the propaganda put out the government is often intended to obscure are real reasons. There is not a lot of policy transparency. The likely story is that the government has always distrusted people who have a source of loyalty, a sense of loyalty, other than a willingness to obey the party. And so when you have an independent sense of ethno-religious identity, they're Uyghur people, they're not Chinese, so they might feel different and, you know, separate from the party. They also believe in God, those who are particularly religious, but they have a Muslim identity, a religious identity that's much stronger than any religious identity among Chinese people. So because of their faith and their they are seen as threats.
So the communists are fighting, according to what I've read, these three evils: terrorism, separatism, and extremism. And I would imagine for Xi Jinping, who has made no bones about the fact that he is the worst kind of communist dictator, this would be threatening insofar as they see themselves separately. And this was sort of a gradual increase, wasn't it, over a period of many years where they obviously felt in Beijing that there was some call for these concentration camps. And what I've read is that over periods of time, there were increasing levels of monitoring. They began with nocturnal arrests. DNA samples began. This has to be, in my view, something very akin to 1930s Germany with the Jews. It began in little ways that seemed sort of inconvenient, but innocuous enough to let go. At what point did this community as a whole realize that this was truly mass incarceration?
Oh, great question. Uyghurs have suffered from open discrimination and really some horrific kinds of state abuse, like intellectuals taken away and given long sentences for basically for thought crimes, right? If they wrote a poem or sang songs that became too popular, and they would be accused of separatism, and then you could go away to a 10 or 12-year prison term. That was a long time ago, over decades, past decades. In this case, I will say that even the Uyghur Human Rights Project, which I work for, which is a full-time documentation organization, a very small one, did not realize the full scale of this wide-scale sweep. Some villages, half the people taken up, some university departments, every professor taken away. Why was it not realized for a while after it began a little bit in the fall of 2016 and then starting in March and April 2017? Because it's happened before. People, relatives would disappear, or relatives would say, oh, stop calling me, it's not safe. They'd been through that before. They said, okay, I'll let it aside. And then as the months go by, people outside the country started to realize what was happening. These are Uyghurs who have their relatives at home. They came to America to go to school, or they're, you know, serving as a doctor or an entrepreneur here. And the veil of secrecy. The government has resolutely cut off communications and tried to keep everything they're doing a complete secret.
Now, part of their effort has been something that they deem to be stabilization. What is the context for this stabilization? What is it precisely that they mean?
Great question. You'll see government newspapers or policy papers talking about threats of the sense of separatism, the separate identity turning into separatism, meaning wanting to split the country, so that's a national security concern. Also, certainly the party is concerned about protests, whether that's people expressing themselves in poetry, literature, online communications through social media, or through organizing a peaceful march, and certainly violent attacks, for example, I'll get on a police station. And there were some cases of this. Everywhere in China, police stations have been attacked when, let's say, the local official's son runs somebody over with a car and then gets away with it and is not taken. People get so angry, or somebody is sexually assaulted, or their land is taken. That happens everywhere in China, where the villagers will simply come en masse, and then they get so angry they might torch a police car, or they might throw windows through rocks through a window. When it happens in the Uyghur region, the the assumption is that this is some kind of violent terrorism. Mm. So that threat was seen as terrible. And so gradually, one of the original thoughts was, oh, economic development will make people happy. That didn't work. So then they turned to repression.
Oh, and these kidnappings happening in the middle of the night, increasing in frequency and intensity, the story that we've referenced today specifically, the story of Sayra Ghul, really sort of draws to light some of the interior workings of these concentration camps, who we are told, of course, here in the Western press, oh, they're simply re-education camps, and we see the footage of the forced smiles, and aren't we all happy learning a trade, and we're receiving instruction, and we're learning new skills, when in fact, torture was very much a part of the daily routine. Can you give us a sense, because you track this so closely, of what particular types of tortures the Chinese are inflicting on Uyghur Muslims?
Yes, and this is a vast region, you understand, right? Their official statistics say there are 12 to 13 million Uyghurs, and many Kazakhs, people of Kazakh ethnic identity, are also caught up. So there are a lot of centers, and they hold a lot of people, and so the techniques are not necessarily going to be the same in all of them. Of course, again, as we heard from Sayra Ghul's story, she had to sign a paper saying that if she made a mistake or she told anyone outside the camps what happened inside, she could face severe punishment and possibly the death penalty. So with that blanket of secrecy, it's a miracle we know anything about it at all. People have risked their lives to tell the story, to bring it forward. And we've heard electric shocks. We've heard beatings. We've heard of mind-altering drugs that cause disorientation, as well as interfering with reproduction. And then we've had humiliation, ritual humiliation. We've had sexual assault, which has been very slow to come out, and that's always the case in these cases where people are very reluctant to give evidence or to testimony about sexual assaults they've experienced or witnesses, but that is now beginning, just now, to be coming out.
Some of these specifics that were mentioned in Sayra Ghul's story about her period of detention were shocking. She talked about a black room that inmates were forbidden from mentioning and in which she knew, based on the condition of the individuals who left it, they were engaging in all forms of torture. Prisoners made to sit on chairs of nails, people returning from the room, their skin filleted or covered in blood, some without fingernails. And the realm of punishments for the fitting of particular sins is really something that had me flabbergasted. They administered these types of tortures for not learning Chinese properly, sleeping on the wrong side. They were required to sleep on the right side as opposed to the left side, refusing to sing propaganda songs. And Sayra Ghul actually had particularly poignant things to say. She talked about the young girls, and when she was telling this story, after having sought asylum in Sweden, what did she say about the guards' relationship to these young girls?
Yeah. Well, this is what you may expect in a situation where there's total power, no controls on what guards may do, and they've been told you need to exercise strict discipline and punish these people. So this is Ms. Sayra Ghul is reporting that everyone knew that the guards could take anyone they wanted, and they would take the young ones. And she said in some cases you would never see them again. In other cases, people would come back and they just looked too traumatized, and you could only imagine what had happened to them. So that there's just the most horrific kinds of sexual abuse and gang rape are happening on a regular basis inside, as well as incredibly cruel physical torture of other kinds. One person she saw a case where somebody was standing in there's been reporting of somebody having to stand in a hole in the ground and ice water being poured over them. And that's been reported by a number of two or three people who managed to get out.
So our president here, Tony Perkins, talked yesterday with Adrian Zenz, who is a German Christian who spent years documenting and proving to the West the reality of these Chinese concentration camps for a million Uyghur Muslims. And this became sort of a righteous mission for him. He knew no one was paying attention, and the West was ignorant of these particular tortures and human rights violations. And his research, I mean, slow and tedious, as you can imagine, chronicling these efforts, led him to a trail of bidding papers and budget plans and satellite pictures that showed the construction of these facilities. And his work obviously has been instrumental, and it has compelled us to finally take notice, because I would imagine it's very hard to go up against the Chinese propaganda machine, isn't it?
Absolutely. Adrian Zenz is a real hero as a researcher. In fact, he testified before a congressional commission yesterday, chaired by Congressman McGovern and Senator Rubio. And he said in his opening statement, I was sitting right behind him, he said, "This is the largest incarceration of an ethno-religious group since the Holocaust." He meant to make the comparison to Germany's sin of the century. And in fact, our Secretary of State, Secretary Pompeo, has said this is the stain of the century, that this could be happening in this day and age.
Absolutely. And I think the comparison is absolutely perfect, one to the other. I think what compounds it for me as a Westerner is the injustice of the fact that American entities, big corporate entities who are socially woke to certain causes, have turned an ultimate blind eye or become advocates to Chinese overlords. We're talking NBA, obviously, the most recent fracas, Apple, Google, Hollywood. You make it in Hollywood and it's edited in China. There is such a patent double standard. You have to be infuriated as someone who follows this issue so closely.
You really put your finger on it. The problem is, it's not just the corporations. It's we ourselves as American consumers, when we buy our products, those can come from forced labor. The cotton, 84% of cotton used in China is sourced in the Uyghur region, which is filled with these mass detention centers, which are not only sites of torture but also forced labor, which also reminds us of other 20th century horrors, Stalin's Gulag, the forced labor of the Nazi program in later years. And so it's the corporations need to be held accountable, and we need to be angry at them because they're offering us products and they claim to be ethical. They have ethics statements, and they're not following through.
So we've got about a minute left here, although I have to tell you, Louise, I could continue talking to you because this really is a blood-boiling story. It's hard not to be angry when you hear it. For the average American who is listening to this broadcast, what can we do to help these victims in Chinese concentration camps?
Great question. I would invite people to to visit the website of the Uyghur Human Rights Project, UHRP.org. We actually have a whole page, what you can do. Because people, when they hear these stories, they say, my goodness, what we can do. We are collecting money to help victims, to continue our advocacy work. We are asking people to ask the Olympic Committee, the U.S. National Committee at Olympics. We're sending our athletes to Beijing in 2022. Are they going to be having an Olympics in the shadow of concentration camps? So thinking ahead to asking those institutions and writing to members of Congress and asking them as well to pass the Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act. These are all actions that Uyghurs welcome.
Thank you, Louisa. She is Director of External Affairs, Uyghur Human Rights Project. Visit their site, UHRP.org. Hold your preferred company accountable. Share it on your media platform. Tell them that you see the double standard. And in the meantime, continue to pray for the Uyghur Muslims in northern China. This has been Washington Watch. I've been Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. We hope you have a wonderful weekend, and we'll see you next time on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.